They say east to west, home is best, but where is home?
Welcome to Hometown, the podcast by Episcopal Migration Ministries, the Refugee Resettlement and Welcome Ministry of the Episcopal Church. I'm Kendall Martin.
And I'm Janet Morford. Join us as we seek to build a community of welcome by sharing interviews, stories, and resources to help you advocate for our newest neighbors amidst mass displacement and forced migration. Thank you for being with us. Today's hometown guest is Mohammad Jawad, a colleague in the EMM affiliate network who currently works for Interfaith Works in Syracuse, New York. Mohammad grew up in Syria and was forced to flee after the outbreak of the civil war that changed everything for countless Syrians. After a harrowing journey for his family from Syria to the border with Jordan, they eventually made it to Za'atari refugee camp, where they remained for 10 years before being resettled to the U.S. Mohammad shares with us memories of his hometown, his family's journey, and the determination and patience he used to pursue his dreams during so much uncertainty. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Mohammad. We're so grateful for your time and your willingness to speak with us about your experience. And as you may know, the name of this podcast is Hometown, and that was born out of a conversation around what home means or represents, especially for individuals who've been forced from their home and find themselves making a home in a new land. So we'd love to hear about your hometown in Syria, what it was like for you growing up, or what you, you know, remember and love from that time.
Of course. I would like to thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to share my story. I really appreciate it. Let me first introduce myself. My name is Mohammad Jawad, originally from Syria. I grew up in the province of Daraa in southern Syria. Our life was very simple. We enjoyed every part of it. Because being a part of a large family with 8 sisters and 2 brothers, and my parents and myself, there was no dull moment. We played together, worked together around the house, and went to school not knowing where's life would take us. We support each other. We loved each other. And at the same time, I had many friends, many neighborhoods. I played video games with them, and we had a fun, and it was so good. In general, we spoke Arabic language, which was the population language or the official language in my country. I was diligent in my studies, and I always achieved excellent grades. My dream was to become a software engineer because my passion and love for technology grew when my father bought me my first computer around 2006, and it was amazing. And since it was new, I filled it with video games until it became infected with viruses. So, I remember a funny conversation I had with my mom about viruses. When I asked her for some money, she asked why. And I said, I wanted to repair the computer. She asked why I wanted to fix something that was still new. And I replied that it had a virus. He simply said, I'm afraid for you, my son. Go and throw it in the garbage so you don't catch the infection from this virus. So I was very impressed at that moment, and I laughed a lot. I also remember working with my father in a building material. So because we had construction factory, like concrete blocks like this. So I was working with my dad and helped with that, like pouring concrete or making blocks. And I tried to be helpful for my father. In general, my life was beautiful. Mix of all these aspects. I took the first step towards my dream by completing a high school and enrolling in the university to study computer science and programming. I was very happy with that achievement, but unfortunately the joy didn't last long.
We just left everything behind us and was disappointed.
We can imagine how disappointing, how heart-wrenching that was. What do you think is important for people to know or to understand about the conditions in which people like you and your family lived in Syria in the late 1990s and into the 2000s? And you said life was good and life was simple. And then the war developed. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. I believe it's important to know that living in Syria during that period of time, since 1990s and 2000, had its challenge. Its challenges, because there were times of stability, but also times of uncertainty, especially with the political tension and economic struggles. So the adults in my life had concerns about providing for their families and ensuring our safety. They hoped for a better future with opportunities for children to thrive or to have a good education or to live without fear. As for me, I shared those hopes for a bright future, and I wanted to pursue my passion, have a successful career, and contributing positively to society. But as the situation in Syria became more difficult, those hopes seemed harder to achieve.
If you had been able to stay in Syria, do you think you would have gone to college and gotten a job? And I mean, what were your hopes for the future if the war had not intervened?
I believe this war will not stop. And if I just stay in Syria, that's all my dreams will be destroyed. And maybe I will die right now because there is no hope. There's no mercy there, just killing. I don't know.
Mm. And Mohammed, when those events happen and, you know, it's complete crisis and people have to flee because there's no other option and they're thrust into what ends up being a very lengthy process if they're trying to apply for refugee status. And I'm curious, from your experience, what exactly that path looked like. You know, if you could speak to if you were first in a refugee camp before you moved on, or what was that process for you of trying to figure out what the next step was going to be for you and your family?
Actually, we tried to stay in Syria by looking for safe place inside Syria, but we could not find this place.
Destruction engulfed the country. I began to feel like a stranger in my own land. We moved around a lot within Syria, searching for a safe place just to protect my family. But the war reached every inch of our land. We lost many friends and loved ones. Our victory was destroyed, and all those big hopes and dreams shattered. Our main concerns become avoiding bolts or having the roof collapse on us due to the artillery shells or war blindness. Our only focus was to have a comfortable sleep and eat light meals. It was a war. Yes, it was a war. And there was no place for us amidst all that trouble. We had leave eventually, clinging to our last breath. So there's no place. We have to make a decision. We decided to go to Jordan to find the safe place. We could not find it in my country. So our journey was very difficult. We were exposed to gunfire and faced many challenges until we finally reached the Syrian-Jordanian border. Our suffering did not end there, because the border crossing was closed to refugees. So we slept under the open sky, shivering from hunger and cold, hoping for a bright tomorrow. I don't know, hopefully, to find that bright tomorrow. After a month in the situation, the border crossing opened at night, as if it were a judgment day. People rushed to the crossing gates to border tracks for refugees. Like a herd of cattle, the journey wasn't long in those tracks. It only took about an hour. But in that hour, my feelings were in a turmoil, and memories squeezed my heart. I wondered where this life would take us. I carried the heavy burdens. I was young, but it felt like I had lived a thousand years. Finally, our last refuge. Welcome to the Azadir refugee camp for Syrian refugees. It was dark, and we didn't know where we had arrived. We slept like the dead from execution, but when the dust cleared and morning came, the shock that changed everything for me was seeing the gravel and sand. Then, looking at crowded tents, seeing people racing for the water tanks to fill some containers, and then looking at the shared bathrooms, I realized that everything was over and hopes and dreams were shattered. It was a situation that sent shivers down my spine. Waking up in the morning and realizing that everything had changed, and adapting to a new life routine, a tent. Yes, a tent. It is my new home, but with the flavor of dust, gravel, barren desert, scattered dreams and memories. So I say from this platform, it was very difficult, but among the rocks, flowers bloom.
Throughout that process, was there someone who helped you to apply with UNHCR to be formally recognized as refugees?
The UNHCR, they can't help us because there's a war, and they can't reach this place that we were existed. Like on the border, they can't access because there's a lot of rockets, a lot of bombs. It's just coming from the Syrian regime. Syrian army, and there's a lot of people killed there, so they can't do anything because they didn't have a tools to do that. So the UNHCR just inside the camps and inside the Jordan, not in the borders.
So when you enter the camp, do you automatically have an interview with UNHCR representatives? We understand they couldn't be in Syria, but once you were admitted to Jordan and you and your family found your way to, I think it was the Atadi refugee camp, then is there a UNHCR presence there in the camp?
Yes. Once we arrived in Jordan, we arrived in the Zaatar refugee camp, and we stay about 7 days without anything. Then we just visit the UNHCR office to make our registration with them. And this was the interview after 7 days, and they make paperwork and they're giving us the food and everything.
It sounds incredibly difficult. And you and your family were then remained in the refugee camp in Jordan for a very long time, like 10 years at least?
Yes. We spent 10 years in the Zaatar refugee camp as refugees.
Were you being told during that time about how long you might have to wait or what the process was going to be?
So it was disappointed, literally. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of hopes, a lot of dreams that came with us from Syria. And when we just saw the real life in the Zaatar and the refugee camp in general, it was difficult because these dreams cannot be come true depending on the situation there. Mm-hmm. Because there's no life. No resources, like a war, no internet, no schools, no jobs. This was difficult. And during this period, we just tell ourselves we have to be patient. We have to patient more, and tomorrow will be better than today. And we not accepted this.
Yeah, that just demands incredible resilience. And from what we understood, you nonetheless achieved some important milestones in your life during the time while you were waiting to find out from the UNHCR if you would be resettled. So you said that you qualified for a scholarship from the European Union, and you began working on a bachelor's degree in computer science. Could you tell us more about how you did that and what that opportunity meant for you?
Sure. I'm a person who's mindful. I'm trying to reach the limits and push myself to move forward to get opportunities or learn myself. So I started just looking for a new opportunity to complete my study, to find a job. So I got a scholarship from the European Union. It was a turning point for me. It was whole process, but I was determined to pursue higher education despite the opportunity and meant everything to me. So I provided a path of academic and professional growth, offering hope for a better future, studying a computer science and open doors to a field I was passionate about and equipment with available skills for the future.
Can you just explain a little more? How were you able to study for this degree when internet access was so limited? Did you figure out a way?
Yes, I just was using some legal tools like VPNs, like softwares, and basic antenna to get this internet. And maybe I just walked more than 2 kilometers to get internet.
Wow.
Sometimes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so in that context, you also began using those skills in informational technology, and you began to work with various organizations in Jordan, in particular, some who work with refugees. Could you tell us about some of those early work opportunities that you managed to find?
Actually, I worked with many organizations inside the camp that working with refugees, with many majors like IT, like social mobilization, like health. So I started with NRC, Norwegian Refugee Council, as a data entry. Mm. I was responsible for a student registration and absence, something like that. Then I get a promotion with NRC to be IT coordinator. I'm sorry, IT technical support. I started providing technical support for staff and networking, provided technical support for students. And I got my another promotion there to be IT coordinator. So I was responsible for IT equipment, like computers, everything related to IT, the infrastructure, and I responsible for providing reports, follow up with the staff and what they need and implementation. Then I got my another organization opportunity, mm-hmm. job opportunity with ACTED. They're working with refugee also. I get my opportunity to be a social mobilization officer with them. So that's marriage between IT and socialize. I worked more than 2 years with them, and I got another promotion to be MIS officer, which is Management Information Systems Officer, which was turning my life to better. I worked with also with Save the Children. They're working with health department beside the UNHCR. It was during the COVID-19 pandemic. I was responsible to follow up with the UNHCR and how many doses and how many persons that already took the vaccine or vaccinated. Then wow. Then I just back to my previous job with different position. It was social mobilization of senior officer. And that was the last.
You were very busy.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
And you told us also that during that time that you fell in love and you started a family. Was this while you were still in Jordan?
Yes, actually, I fell in love with an NRC because my wife right now, she was working with me in NRC, which is Norwegian Refugee Council. She was working with different departments, but beautician coach, something like that, makeup and hair. I meet her there and we got married in 2015 in Jordan.
Wow. It's very interesting because although on the one hand, possibilities are so limited in a refugee camp, you really did so much and you got a scholarship and you earned degrees and you did all these jobs and you fell in love and married and started a family. It's really quite remarkable. Is there anything else about this part of your journey that you think is important to understand?
I believe this part of my journey tough me resilience, adaptability, and importance of CSI. So as I said, it was tough,
mm-hmm.
and the importance of seizing opportunities, no matter how difficult you will face or how many load on your back, just keep going and try to make your dreams come true with any reason, hard work, push yourself, and you will see your dreams will come true.
That's beautiful, Mohammed.
Yeah.
You've had quite the journey, and I think it can be hard for people who don't fully understand resettlement, just how long it can take from originally when you've had to been forced to flee your home, and then the process to hopefully one day be resettled. And I'd love to hear from you about what it was like for you once you received refugee status and you came to the US in 2023, what that experience of arrival was like for you, you know, what your first experiences or impressions of that were.
Actually, when I just get this opportunity to be resettlement to USA, so it was belated. So I almost die, literally, because it's like a gate, life gate, and mm-hmm. you will start a new life. And when I say life, it's a true life. Right. Not like refugee camp life, not like other countries' life, which is USA, which is United States of America. And it was my dream. So I literally was elated and super excited.
And do you remember when you first arrived to the US?
I arrived in USA last April 2023, mm-hmm. and we spent 2 days for the fly. It was difficult, but we just arrived.
Right.
And it was beautiful.
So we understand, Mohammed, that you came to live in Syracuse, New York, with support from a local nonprofit organization called RISE, which stands for Respect, Inspiration, Service, and Empathy. Why did you request or choose to live in Syracuse, or were you just assigned to Syracuse by chance?
Actually, I have my friend in Syracuse, living here in Syracuse. So when I complete my application to resettlement, they ask me to determine someone who will be a sponsor when I arrived in USA to help me just to, and the basic things like provide me with information about the country, about hospitals, about everything. Then I determined to my friend as a sponsor, which is USDAI. I just assigned my friend as a sponsor. So I chose Syracuse depending on my friend locate.
Okay. And how did you get connected with the organization called RISE? Were they known for resettling refugees? Or
actually, I don't have an idea about RISE because I didn't know about agencies that located in Syracuse. So it just my luck. They assigned me to this organization to help me with the first 90 days, which is 3 months. To working with me, to preparing my documents like social, like insurance, health insurance, and food stamp for 90 days, and make some procedures.
Mm-hmm. So when you think back to those first few weeks and months of living in Syracuse, what was most important for you and your family?
So the most important thing that I don't afraid of tomorrow. I don't afraid of my children's future. Mm-hmm. We have a home and we have a good education. We don't have a tent.
Mm-hmm.
A tent.
Mm-hmm.
And we are safe.
Mm-hmm.
Mohammed, one of the things that we try to do at EMM is really to encourage communities and congregations to offer welcome. And I'm curious for you, you know, what your experience was in being welcome to both Syracuse and the U.S. And if there's anything that you wish more people in the U.S. understood about how to genuinely make newcomers feel respected and truly welcomed in their communities.
Yes. So of my point of view, I wish more people understood the challenges refugees face and the resilience they demonstrate in starting anew in a foreign land. And refugees often arrive with like a huge emotional and bad experience from their countries and bad experience and faced significant barriers or rebuilding their lives in the new country. I believe for someone entering the U.S. As a refugee, possible next steps may including applying for finding the local communities, community centers that help refugees, something like that. They're providing services. They guide the new people, which is a new American, to starting their life.
And when you've emphasized the importance of these organizations like RISE in helping people go through the procedures and just get their basic needs met during the first few months. Was there anything in that process that people did or didn't do that really made you feel welcome in the United States?
Yes, actually, they provide us with information about, it's called cultural orientation. They give us information about how we can using the bus station, how we can using the services. They provide us with information about the government phone numbers, like hospital, emergency, and they provide us with gifts and a lot of foods. They feel like they care about us. So it was very, very cool.
So just the fact that people thought about all the things that you would need, all the different kinds of knowledge, but also providing some material goods, food, yes, and clothes and the things that you needed, but a lot of it just explaining how things work in the U.S. was really helpful. So we know that you entered the U.S. with the status of refugee, and some people come in with another status. They might be SIV, they might be humanitarian parolee. But since you were a refugee, did that determine in any way the kind of support that you were eligible for, either from the government or from local organizations like RISE?
Actually, as a Syrian, our status is refugee, which is still waiting to the final decision of your application. So I arrived in USA as a refugee with my family, and we're still waiting our green card application. We should apply next April, because next April we will be complete 1 year in USA. That will allow us to apply for green cards.
Right. So if someone comes into the U.S. as a refugee, they have to wait a year, but then they can apply for a green card and become a legal permanent resident.
It's depending on the status. So some people coming, like as you mentioned before, SIV, which is once they arrived in the airport, they will obtain the green card. But it's depending on the case and from like the country that they come from and other things.
Right. Is there anything that you wish more people in the United States understood about what it means to come here as a refugee?
Yes. I need just to remind the people that we are human beings, and it's so hard to be a refugee, and all people looking at you like a refugee. So the refugee means you just leaving your country, your people, and all things that you have to just looking for a safe place and to avoid to involving in this war or killing people or do something bad. So I just need to remind people that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And as a reminder to our listeners, adults who enter the U.S. with refugee status are able to work as soon as they have their social security and their work authorization documents. So, Mohammed, could you tell us about your experience of coming to the U.S. and looking for work using the skills and the education that you had obtained while you were in Jordan?
Yes, actually, depending on the status that arrived in USA as a refugee, I obtained the necessary document to work, which is work authorization and social security number, and I have already the passport that we're coming through. Drawing on my IT background and experience, I actively sought employment. So I just tried to find matched job in my experience and trying to sign into the platforms that connected with the employees, which is LinkedIn, Indeed, and others. So I created my profiles and starting to applying my CV, and I got a lot of interviews with many organizations here. So it was good to starting like connect yourself with employers and finding job opportunities.
Yeah, and it's a lot of work looking for work as well. And now you're an IT manager for Interfaith Works Central New York, which is a large nonprofit providing multiple services, including refugee resettlement and support for new Americans. Could you tell us a little bit about what you do in your role?
So I do a lot. So actually, as the IT manager of Interfaith Works, I responsible to all things related to IT. So it's like technology, infrastructure, and operations. This including development technology, strategies, and organizational goals, managing IT infrastructures, and implementation, softwares, application, and everything. And I'm responsible to working with our partner, our IT service provider, and provide the technical support for staff.
So you are very, very busy is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
So, Mohammed, you work for an organization that resettles hundreds of newcomers every year. So now that you're part of the staff of an organization that does this, has the experience of working for this organization helped you understand anything more about the process of resettlement or the role of nonprofit organizations in being able to resettle refugees?
Yes. Working for resettlement organization has enhanced my understanding of the resettlement process and critical role of non-approveds. It's showing me firsthand the support and resources the newcomers require. The importance of empathy and community involvement in their journey to rebuild their lives.
Mm-hmm. So you said you've become more aware of the importance of not only the support and the resources that people need, like you talked about earlier, but also the importance of empathy and community involvement. So besides the nonprofit organizations like RISE and Interfaith Works, are there other people or groups who are or should be involved in welcoming newcomers to their new communities?
Actually, I believe there's a lot of institutions that are working with the newcomers, but I can mention resettlement agencies and the local community centers, and we have like churches, mm-hmm. and we have mosques, and a lot of people who's individually helping newcomers also.
Mm-hmm. So from what you've seen, the role that lots of different groups and organizations and individual people can play really matters. It really adds up.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask a couple of other things about your family's experience of this transition. So you had children already before you came to the United States, right?
Yes.
And so what has your children's experience of resettlement been like?
They just like the place.
Uh-huh.
As I said before, I'm lucky to get this opportunity, which is changing my life. And depending on changing my life, my children, they will get a new future, new life, and should be bright. And my children were very happy to just arrive in USA. And they're finding everything, like gifts, like games, food. They find the heavens.
And their adjustment to school and to speaking English.
That's
all gone well.
Oh. Is there another part of your journey or your story that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Actually, I would share some. It's not like a story. It's just I would like to thank who has supported me and give me this opportunity to come here. And during these challenges, I found a strength to push my dreams and appreciate the help I have received from the government, the agencies, and the people, and everyone who helped me to be myself right now.
Well, yourself right now is pretty spectacular. So it's very much to our benefit in Syracuse and in the United States to have people like you who bring such a wealth of experience and such a desire to get to work and to pursue your dreams. That's really important to everybody, I think.
Absolutely. And Mohammed, I'm just so grateful for your time. This has just been so wonderful. And one of the questions we love to ask everyone as we end our interviews is for you to share with our listeners what home means to you.
Home to me?
Yes.
Okay. I believe the home is where my family is, where I feel safe and loved. It's not just about the physical location, but rather the people and the scenes of belonging they bring. And the home is where I can be myself and I can create a lasting of memories with my loved ones. So I will just say something. There is a humanity, then I'm a human and I'm at home. That's the important thing.
That's really beautiful. Thank you so much, Mohammed.
Yeah, thank you, Mohammed. You really said so much that's really important. And I really appreciate you sharing so much of your experience and your wisdom with us.
Actually, I would like to thank you to giving this opportunity and sharing my information, my story. A pleasure.
Well, for an honor and a privilege for us also. Thank you for joining us for today's episode. For more resources and opportunities to get involved with Episcopal Migration Ministries, be sure to visit EpiscopalMigrationMinistries.org. You may also find us on Facebook and Instagram, where we are EMM Refugees. To stay up to date on all new episodes, make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts.
This critical work and ministry would not be possible without listeners and supporters like you. To continue to support the Ministry of Welcome, you can make a gift to Episcopal Migration Ministries. With your help, we will continue to welcome and resettle refugees and communities across the country, offer support to asylum seekers, and create beloved community for all of our immigrant siblings. Visit EpiscopalMigrationMinistries.org/give or text hometown to 91999.
Our theme song composer is Abraham Mwinda Ikando. Find his music at abrahammwinda.bandcamp.com.
Until next time, peace be with you and with all those you consider home.
excited to join thousands of Episcopalians, neighbors, and friends this summer at the Love Always Revival at the KFC Yum Center in Louisville, Kentucky. On Saturday, June 22nd, get immersed in inspiring worship and community, deepen your love for God, kick off the 81st General Convention, and extend a warm welcome to folks discovering the Episcopal Church. The revival is free to attend, so bring your friends. If you're from a neighboring diocese, check in with your diocesan revival champion to find out about group travel options. You can find more information along with registration at iam.ec/lovealways.